This is Anya Leonard, the co-founder of Classical Wisdom, a website dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds.
And I'm very happy to say that today we have Associate Professor of Classics at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Emily Baragwanath. First, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Very happy to be here.
And you've been writing extensively on Xenophon, so I think we're very interested to hear more on this subject, but maybe it's best to start with a refresher for those who might enjoy it on who exactly was Xenophon and what's he famous for, essentially?
Okay, well, Xenophon was an Athenian. He was born in the last third of the 5th century BC. He's famous for being a disciple of Socrates, the Athenian philosopher. He's the only Socratic, aside from Plato, whose Socratic writings survive to us. As well as a philosopher, he was a soldier and a writer. And in his most famous work, The Anabasis, he gave an autobiographical account of his own role as a young general. He must have been aged around 30, leading the 10,000 Greek mercenaries from the heartland of the Persian Empire all the way back to Greece. So serving himself as one of the commanders. And he's also famous for a range of other literary works, including a history that carries on from Thucydides' history and tells the story of late 5th and 4th century Greece. He wrote a historical novel on Cyrus the Great, and then a range of other literary works, technical treatises, and other such.
And so you have told me that you've been writing about how he represents women in these works. How does he represent them, and why is it sort of different from anybody else, I guess?
Okay, yeah. Well, I should start by saying that across all of his works, Xenophon's major preoccupation is human relationships, and specifically ideal leadership. This is leadership across any sphere, from monarchy through the military to even household management. And what good leaders do, in Xenophon's opinion, is they create a bond of philia, of friendship, between them and their followers. Basically, it's a relationship characterized by mutuality and reciprocity. The leaders know how to put into effect a common good, one that benefits them and their followers alike. They outdo their followers in their helpfulness, their thoughtfulness, and the upshot is that they're honored and loved by their followers. And what really fascinates me is how Xenophon fits women into this scheme, women of all sorts, from actual rulers to housewives, even to prostitutes. Should I tell you a little bit about a couple of these women, perhaps?
I'd love to, yeah.
Okay, so one of these women, she appears in his Hellenica, his work of history, Mania of Dardanus, who rules, literally rules, on the Asia Minor coast in the zone of Persian influence, so ruling as a sub-satrap under the Persian satrap Pharnabazdus. And Xenophon, in his work of history, he takes time to describe how, after the death of her husband, Mania approached Pharnabazdus and asked that he make her ruler after her husband. And she persuades him to do that. And we find this picture of her charming, diplomatic, and incredibly efficient and effective ruler, more effective even than her husband in winning over cities, becoming also an advisor and friend of Pharnabazdus. And the upshot is that when she is assassinated, Pharnabazdus says that he'd prefer to die than to fail to avenge her. So in a depiction like that, we get a sense of women as especially diplomatic, attentive, appealing, where necessary, deferential, as experts in creating human relationships, whether it's, you know, being great friends themselves or bringing together others, others as friends, and exercising soft power. But even in the case of the Athenian wife, for instance, one most sheltered category of woman, again, Xenophon is interested in the wife and her capacity to exercise leadership within the household. And Xenophon, so he wrote an entire treatise on household management. And early on, you have the philosopher Socrates chatting with another Athenian gentleman. And Socrates says to this man, he says, tell us the truth, Critobulus, since we're all friends here. Is there anyone to whom you trust more serious matters than your wife? And Critobulus says, no, there isn't. And Socrates then says, and is there anyone with whom you have fewer conversations than your wife? And the man admits that that's true too. And then the work goes on and it brings out the importance, the value of what this woman does in the household and has her acting as, you know, in ways that is like a judge or as a garrison commander, and proving, you know, to have these qualities of being a good friend.
Well, I guess that's interesting because Xenophon writes about Socrates, and Socrates' relationship with his wife is kind of famous as well, though not maybe as nicely or equally portrayed.
Yeah, well, actually, in Xenophon, there's a really a wonderful scene in one of his Socratic works where he has Socrates lecturing his own child, his own son, trying to persuade him to be more appreciative of his mother, of Socrates' wife. And basically he says to this child, do you know what mothers have to do, do with their babies? They have to guess what they want. They have to try to supply it. They have to toil night and day, and they do all of this never knowing whether they'll receive anything at all in return. And that scene for me is really interesting because Xenophon's idea of friendship and that sort of creating ideal relationships, it's all about mutuality, it's all about reciprocity. And scenes like that give me the sense that Xenophon sees motherhood as sort of training in those qualities that make you a good friend, and these qualities of not, you know, actually not expecting anything in return, going even one better than expecting reciprocity in a relationship, to do all this selflessly with no expectation of gaining anything in return. So to my mind, a scene like that gives us a clue as to, you know, why it is that women might be, you know, why it is that Xenophon might regard women as especially effective as friends.
Xenophon was also quite famously pro-Sparta, rather than, I mean, it got him in trouble quite a bit throughout his life for his sort of outspoken praise of both the leadership in Sparta and the culture. I guess it's interesting that he might have a different view on women in society, considering that Sparta also had a very different relationship between the men and women than they did in Athens. Like, is that sort of correlated at all to his views on women?
I think that's a great question, and I'd say absolutely. We have a tradition of, women in Sparta as real moral authorities. There's Plutarch, for instance, has a list of, Spartan sayings about women, and they say all of these things to their men, like, you know, come back with your shield or on it, you know, come back having won and not run away, or dead lying on your shield. And I think we get a strong sense across Xenophon's work of women as moral authorities, women as intelligent advisors of men, and men men taking women seriously, taking women and their views seriously, and this as one of the keys to successful leadership, whether it's in the case of Cyrus the Great, who in fact in the Cyropaedia, the work on the upbringing and career of Cyrus the Great, there is a wonderful scene there where we have Cyrus's future wife as, you know, making the decision that she wanted to marry Cyrus and that she, you know, she thinks he's a fantastic man and she'd like to marry him. And the idea that Cyrus would find this, you know, this appealing, that he wants a wife who has herself made the decision to marry him. And in other ways across the work, you get a wonderful sense of leaders being successful, where they are willing to take advice from everyone, including women, where they, you know, sort of aware of this sort of women as a moral authority. And I'd argue that Sparta and Persia fill similar roles in this respect. Xenophon quite often shows us or suggests affinities between Spartan society and Persian society. For instance, in how both put great weight on the quality of obedience. This is one thing. Also in the context of Persia, we have a sense of, you know, influential women. And this is harking back to reality. We know that Achaemenid royal women, they owned property. They had, you know, a certain amount of economic control. They would move quite freely through the empire. There's some really interesting work done on that. So I think Sparta and Persia both are interesting sort of sources of inspiration for Xenophon.
So the next question then is, you know, depending on who you ask, if you go and speak to somebody who's done military training, they've been in the Naval Academy or something like that, they're actually more likely to know Xenophon than most students, academics who, you know, they hear the word Xenophon, they have no idea who you're talking about, but they'll know Plato, you know, they'll know Socrates, they'll know even more likely Thucydides, and here Xenophon has sort of completed his work. So why has this happened to poor old Xenophon? Like, why is he not getting sort of a respect outside of the military world, interestingly enough?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think you're right. And in a sense, I think Xenophon has fallen through the cracks. As you're suggesting there, as a philosopher, he stands in the shadow of Plato. As a historian, he stands in the shadow of Thucydides, unfairly, I would argue, because his historiography is extremely interesting. And in terms of philosophy, he gives us a very different but quite compelling picture, I think, of Socrates. And then again, you mentioned sort of West Point, that enthralling self-depiction Xenophon gives us of his own role as a young commander leading the 10,000 mercenaries. That picture of Xenophon the soldier, Xenophon the commander, has in a sense taken center stage. It's really relegated the other Xenophon, Xenophon the philosopher, Xenophon the historian, Xenophon the writer. Those other Xenophons have been, you know, relegated to the sidelines. And then I think that general underestimation of Xenophon has also led to false assumptions about his social views. Assumptions, for instance, that those close ties to Sparta that we were talking about, and that his personal wealth, that these things mean that he was an oligarch, that he was an aristocrat, and that for this reason, perhaps he's less interesting than he might be. But when you look closely at his complete literary output, you get quite a different picture. You see someone who values people of all sorts in society, from kings to commanders, to common soldiers, to wives, even to courtesans, to prostitutes. And to my mind, this is not elitist at all. So I think another reason Xenophon hasn't found such favor as he deserves is that he's been unfairly perceived as simply being a stodgy old aristocrat. I think his work is much more interesting than that.
It's funny, though, because you think about Thucydides, and, I mean, he was obviously quite wealthy, too. I mean, his failed campaign, he had assumed that he had more power in the area because his family owned silver mines and things like that. Like, he obviously had a great deal of wealth, and yet he's, in history, been given a very prominent position almost because he failed at doing a good job militarily, and then was exiled and was able to focus on writing. And here's Xenophon. Did well in military and writing.
Thucydides, that's a really nice, another aspect of, I think, of the comparison to bring in. Thucydides is also, like Plato, both of them brilliant in their writing, but also notoriously difficult, challenging, hard to read. Even the ancient critics, the ancient literary critics, complain about the difficulty of Thucydides' Greek, for instance, how those speeches couldn't possibly have been delivered before the Athenian assembly. And I think this is another reason, this brings us to another reason why Xenophon's been sidelined, and it's that he is clear and accessible. You know, he was known as the Attic Bee for the clarity of his prose, but also in content, he is trying to he gives us a Socrates also, who is trying to convey knowledge, wisdom, to bring others to understanding. In his work on household management, he makes a great deal of how the earth itself teaches farmers how to farm. Like she does this. She shows by, she'll if you're doing things stupidly, she will punish you by not giving you crops and so on. A sense that for those willing to learn, to be attentive, this wisdom is accessible. It's there. Nature herself is sort of showing you how to do many of these things. Whereas Plato and Thucydides are both far less accessible, far more difficult, difficult to grapple with. Plato's Socrates says, it's quite challenging even to figure out exactly, what the content of that wisdom, that Sophia is. But in Xenophon, that is not the case. Like many wise people across history, he will give you so the same lessons in different guises, different forms, perhaps tailored to different audiences, some quite simple or readily graspable concepts that keep on coming back again and again. And I think for this as well, he has been, thought to be less profound than some of the more difficult, inaccessible writers.
Punished for being too accessible and for being too aristocratic.
To be accessible is to, there's a democratic aspect to it, that everyone can learn from, the housewife on. Everyone who wants can learn, and there's something profoundly democratic about that.
Well, I think you're doing a great effort in bringing justice to this ancient philosopher and warrior and historian. Just to finish up, can you tell me a little bit about what you're working on now?
Well, as you may have guessed, I'm writing a book on Xenophon's women. What I'm trying to do is to show that Xenophon is a writer with coherent social themes, with a distinct viewpoint on women, but also on society more generally, as so often at one's attitude to women in antiquity as now, it tends to reflect your broader social attitudes. So that's the content of it. At the same time, I'm trying to show that he is a sophisticated writer, how effectively he works across an array of literary genres, whether it's philosophical dialogue, historiography. In each case, he's He's aware of the genre he's working in, of contemporaries, predecessors, and engaging in really very interesting ways with preceding, like in the case of history, with Herodotus, with Thucydides, with preceding historiography. And above all, that he's a neglected but an important stepping stone when it comes to the history of literary depictions of gender. He really is fascinating. So that is the case I'm trying to make.
Well, it sounds absolutely fascinating, and you'll have to tell me when the book is out. I will update with links below and look forward to reading it myself. So, I just want to say thank you again for talking to me today. And it sounds really interesting hearing more about Xenophon and his depiction of women.
Well, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.